Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Before we get started today, a reminder that KBOO's end of year membership drive is going on. KBOO is commercial free, volunteer powered radio made possible by listeners like you. Please help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And thank you very much. Every little bit helps, so please chip in. It's a choice, and it's a choice that I'm urging you to make because we as human beings are always making choices, including what we say and how we act every day. We tend to barrel ahead on a path that is easy and pleasurable. We try to avoid pain and we seek immediate gratification, often when some part of our mind is throwing up red flags as we make our choices. The book we'll be discussing today shows you how to give your conscience more sway in your life so that your decisions will support and guide you to act for the highest good, for your highest good and the highest good of all. Our guest is Leonard Perlmutter, author of the new book, Your Conscience, The Key to Unlock Limitless Wisdom and Creativity and Solve All of Life's Challenges. Leonard is the founder and director of the American Meditation Institute in Averill Park, New York. He's the author of the best-selling The Heart and Science of Yoga and the originator of National Conscience Month. Leonard also serves as the author and editor of Transformation, the Journal of Meditation as Mind-Body Medicine. Hello, Leonard, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
I love this little book, Your Conscience. You know, how long has it been since I've heard that word used in common parlance? You know, it almost goes back to Jiminy Cricket. And I want to start by asking you, how would you define it? How do you define conscience? And what is conscience relying on in terms of any decision-making sway that it offers?
Well, the conscience is very interesting. It is one of four functions of the mind. And the mind is very interesting because it is the mind that must move first before the body can take an action. And of course, when we do take an action, it always brings about a consequence. This became Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal reaction. But the conscience is the only function of the mind that can discriminate, determine, judge, and decide. It's what tells us what to do and what not to do.
If we access it. Right.
Excuse me?
Only if we access it.
Well, that's true. But Here's the real inside story is that because the conscience is the only function of the mind that can decide, the conscience is the only decision maker in the mind. In other words, every single choice that you or I have made in the past or will ever take in the future has been and always will be made by the conscience.
Wow. You know, that's a really interesting positioning because you never hear that. Freud
talked
about the superego.
Mm-hmm.
How is the conscience different than that?
So,
same thing.
There are three additional functions of the mind, but the other three are not decision makers. They cannot make a decision, they are simply advisors. And these three are loud, pushy, and insistent. They're very strong lobbyists for their limited point of view. The first of which is the ego, as you mentioned. Now, the ego, seems to me, is hardwired to the reptilian brain because everything that the ego does seems to be in service to self-preservation. And like the reptilian brain, the ego has this terrible, terrible fear of annihilation. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want the form to end. And in service to that, that deep driving desire to maintain the integrity of the form, the ego is always present in the decision-making process. And it seems to me that the ego cuts everything in half. On one side, the ego says, this is very pleasant. I like it. Let's reprise it. I think this is good. But over here on this side, this is very unpleasant. I consider this bad. I dislike it. Let's avoid it. Let's eliminate it. So from its limited perspective, with the deep driving desire for self-preservation, the ego lobbies in favor of two concepts, likes and dislikes. Right. It likes the likes and wants to reprise them and wants to eliminate the dislikes. But you know, if we're honest with one another, we'll all agree that there are certain things that appear as pleasant that I like, which aren't good for me. And there are things that appear as unpleasant. I consider that I dislike it, but it's not bad for me. So if I get locked in, which I have gotten locked into and attached to the limited perspective of the ego, when the ego is often wrong, that expresses itself through my mind-body-sense complex as what? Pain. And I'm in pain. Physical, mental, emotional, even spiritual pain.
You mean when you go against your conscience?
That's right. That's right. Because that creates a conflict in the mind between inner wisdom, the wisdom of the conscience, and the action that I ultimately take. And if I maintain inner conflict, that becomes the mother of all problems.
Well, you know, an argument could be made that conscience relies on a value system that we've learned to make these judgments. You know, that word judge, you said it's the only part that judges, that really triggers me, because I was taught as a young Catholic boy going to first confession that I'm supposed to judge myself, and that is, the conscience seemed like the source of pain to me, because it was judging my behavior according to what the priest said was right and wrong. And so what are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thought immediately goes to the highest principle of yoga science. The highest principle means non-injury, non-harming, non-violence. We are to take no action in the world that is injurious, both to myself and others.
Right.
So if I am aware of guilt, and that's painful, it's up to us to sacrifice that energy and transform it into a positive form of energy.
Right, but I'm just saying a lot of guilt is manufactured. It's not warranted. It's taught, children are taught to feel guilty about innocent things.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's right. But
conscience is a cause of pain in that case.
So what we really need to be taught is not to be reactionary. So if somebody offers us poison, we're not under any obligation to accept it. Thank you, I have no need for this. Thank you for the guilt, but I have no need for this.
Well, that's something that's possible for an adult to say who's not terrified by the authority figures that are threatening mm-hmm. him with hell and punishment.
Yes.
So we learn at an early age. I don't know, I'm really reflecting my own history and conditioning about how I learned to feel guilty and to always be looking for things to feel guilty about. And so I, you know, that's why conscience is a little bit.
Well, but then at a certain point of maturity, I have to ask myself in that kind of conditioning, how's that working for me?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And so then I realize that whoever was modeling that for me was simply modeling it as a teaching of what not to do and how not to act.
Right.
That's all.
Right. So where does conscience get its wisdom?
When there's quietude in the mind, and we can parent and train the ego and the senses and the unconscious mind, these three amigos, these three lobbyists, if we can quiet them, teach them to be quiet in that quietude, then the conscience has the capacity to act and operate as a mirror. It can reflect superconscious wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind at the core of our being. That's the same portion of the mind now where Paul McCartney hears beautiful melodies and Albert Einstein saw mathematical equations. Doesn't mean that if we access this superconscious wisdom and employ it, that we're going to become a physicist or a songwriter. But what it does mean is the more that I can parent the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind to support this superconscious wisdom reflected by the conscience, every thought, every word, and every act will then lead me for my highest and greatest good.
So it probably behooves us to slow down and allow ourselves to avoid reaction and impulse, you know, develop some impulse control, because I think people have a kind of a hair trigger reaction to something that's scary or painful.
And that, well, that's being supported by the culture, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
All of a sudden the culture has this new programming. They call it multitasking. Oh, do two things, three things at the same time. And we know, and scientists and physicians know, that it's impossible for the mind to do two things at the same time. And so to go back and forth with the mind between two objects very quickly to provide the delusion that we're multitasking, there has to be a tremendous amount of hormones. Adrenaline has to surge through the entire physiology. And what is the bottom line there? Oh, it depresses the immune system and the mind becomes depressed. Uh-huh. But when we can learn to do one thing at a time with complete one-pointed attention, then we can create a space between stimulus and response. And in that space between stimulus and response lies our freedom of choice,
right?
To check with the conscience, to determine the thought to think, the word to speak, the action to take that will always lead me for my highest good.
Do you think that superconscious wisdom is basically what a lot of people mean by the word soul?
Yes, that's just a synonym.
Uh-huh, okay. And so,
in fact, the soul contains an intuitive library of wisdom, and that intuitive library of wisdom that is part and parcel, indistinguishable from the soul, is what we refer to as the superconscious portion of the mind.
Right. Now, you mentioned the senses, the ego, the unconscious.
Yes.
And it seems to me that of those three, the unconscious is probably, the subconscious is probably the most powerful one.
It's very powerful because it's our software package. It's the programming.
We're not aware of it. You know, it sneaks up.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Most people are just skimming along the surface of consciousness on autopilot. And when that occurs, it's the software program that is pulling the strings of the marionette. So it begs the question, doesn't it? Whose life am I living? Am I living my mother's, my father's, my grandmother, my grandfather, the politicians? That's why I tell people that one of the most important teachers I have ever had in my entire life has been Elvis Presley.
And how is that?
Well, I fell in love with Elvis when I was 10, and I've loved him every single day since. And I'm not a kid anymore.
What did you learn from Elvis?
Well, the most important thing I learned by observing him and giving all that attention to him is that I was able to see choices that he made that were in conflict with my own inner wisdom. So on a very practical, commonsensical level, Elvis Presley taught me which burners on the stove were hot and which burners on the stove were not hot. And I'm eternally grateful to that teaching for teaching me what not to do.
Well, are you wearing blue suede shoes?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay. So now getting back to your book, you say that there are two kinds of thoughts. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's critically important that we continuously watch the mind. Not only watch the mind, but understand which function of the mind authors the thoughts. Which thought is heavily invested in that thought? Ego, senses, unconscious mind. Yeah. And so when we understand that, we come to see that there are two forms of thoughts. We call them preya and shreya. Fortunately, they rhyme to help us human beings remember them. Now, the preya is the ground upon which the personality stands. It's some form of ego or sense gratification that conflicts with our inner wisdom, that conflicts with the superconscious wisdom reflected by the conscience. There's no doubt that the preya is pleasant, it's comfortable, it's familiar, and it's attractive. But after the passing pleasure is gone, in its wake is always left some form of physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual dis-ease or pain. And if we don't heed the lesson of the pain at a low decibel level, the decibel level simply gets louder and louder and louder till we can't avoid it.
And is the conscience, the conscience as a function always knows the difference between these two?
That's right.
I mean, because pleasure in and of itself is not a bad thing.
That's right. Sometimes it's just the ticket. I love a good tasting meal. I have a body. I have senses. I love a delicious dessert. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the truth be known, you and I both need a very healthy ego. We would not be able to have this conversation if we did not have a healthy ego. We would not be able to drive an automobile or a truck if we did not have a healthy ego.
Right.
But the ego and the senses and the unconscious mind, these advisors of the mind, they're only limited in their perspective. It's like looking out your window and proclaiming that what you can see represents the entire panorama around the building. It's not true.
Right.
But you see, the conscience is not looking through a window. It's on top of the roof and has a 360-degree panoramic view of what's to be done and what's not to be done. And it's a little bit like those gangster movies where you hear that famous line, something to the effect, "Nothing personal, strictly business." It's like Spock telling Captain Kirk not to be so emotional.
Right.
That, you know, there's certain things that we have to do.
So I take it then that the problem that can be solved by relying on the conscience is the discernment between the preya and the shreya. Is that
right? That's right. Yes, because the shreya always has the good housekeeping seal of approval of the conscience, and it will always lead us for our highest and greatest good. It might not be so attractive initially, but it always leads us for our highest good.
Right. So it might involve some sacrifice of an impulse towards immediate gratification.
That's true. But in that case, we see that not as a denial, but as a positive thing.
Well, okay. We see it as a positive thing. How would you frame that? What makes it positive?
Because it's always leading me for my highest good. And if I indulge in that ego or sense gratification in the short term, I'm going to wind up in pain. And I have a whole history, if I look through the rearview mirror, at all the pain that I experienced because I was fooled.
Right. You know, isn't it exhausting to rely on the conscience all the time? It sounds like a lot of work. You know, you've got to pay attention to your thoughts all the time.
Well, yes and no.
I'm not complaining. I'm asking on behalf of my listeners.
Well, yes and no is the answer. And that is, I remember when I was 15 years old and I was learning how to drive an automobile. Oh, it was very stressful. And I had to concentrate tremendously. It was a lot of work to learn how far to turn the wheel to the right, how far to turn the wheel to the left, how much gasoline am I going, how much pressure am I going to apply to the gas pedal so that I can take off smoothly, or how much pressure am I going to apply on the brakes smoothly so that I can come to a nice, soft stop. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, as a human being, I create a global skill. And all those individual aspects become rather pleasant, and I don't even think about it anymore. All there is driving, and it can be a joy. Mm-hmm. It's the same with using the conscience. Yes, there's a little bit of work involved in learning how it works, but the one thing about human beings is that we are habit makers. We're habit makers. We're good at that. And so we can create a global skill so that using the conscience consciously becomes our way of being in the world.
Now, you have a concept in the book, The Bridge of Yoga. I don't know if that originated with you or not, but what does it mean?
Well, it just seemed like a logical aspect to the teaching, because so much of our problem is the fact that most human beings are externally oriented. Most human beings have such an intense sense of lack of what my capability is. I see myself as an individual in this vast universe of objects, and I want to be happy. I want to be secure. I want to be healthy. And the culture suggests to me, oh, if you want to be happy, you want to be secure, you want to be healthy, look outside of yourself to these experts, and they will provide you, or certain objects that will make you happy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's just not true. Mm-hmm. So I need to learn to counsel within so I can take that inner wisdom that is faultless and unerring and turn it into my thoughts, words, and actions in the world. So the bridge of yoga is what enables me to, in every situation, base my outer action on my inner wisdom.
Okay. And how does meditation fit into all of this? I mean, you're
exquisitely.
Okay. I mean, you founded the American Meditation Organization.
Yes.
So obviously you're pro meditation.
I am pro meditation. That is true. I plead guilty.
So,
but it's only on a practical level that I came to that conclusion. Why? Because meditation, first of all, does something that nothing else can do. It finally introduces us to ourselves so that we know who we are, we know from where we have come, we know why we're here, we know what's to be done, and we know where we're going when the body is no more. That's number one.
That happens through a process of elimination.
That's right.
I'm not my feelings, I'm not my body.
That's right. The process is called neti neti, not this, not this. I have a body, but I am not the body. Right. I have the thought, but I have a relationship with the thought, but I am not the thought.
Right.
Right.
Well, how can people learn more about your teaching?
Well, I founded, as you mentioned, the American Meditation Institute in 1996. That's where I teach. We have programs. We have free guided meditations every Sunday morning from 9:30 to 11. There's a free link on our website homepage. The website is americanmeditation.org, americanmeditation.org. And the book, the new book, Your Conscience, also has its own little website, and it's yourconscience.org.
Okay.
Yourconscience.org.
It's a beautiful book. I really want to encourage our listeners, get a copy, and it's very readable and it's very clear, and so are you. And thank you very much for being on the show today. There's so much more we could explore, but unfortunately we have run out of time. And so I want to encourage our listeners to go to your website, AmericanMeditation.org, maybe take a look at the book, and you'll be glad you did. And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play or share this entire interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. And today, we've been visiting with Leonard Perlmutter, author of Your Conscience, The Key to Unlock Limitless Wisdom and Creativity and Solve All of Life's Challenges. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every other Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. And that's the same website that you can go to if you remember to help KBOO reach our $45,000 membership drive goal. So please show your support today. Just go to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to number 44321. Every donation helps and is greatly appreciated. And Pathways, which has been a show on KBOO for almost 40 years, and for which I've been the volunteer host for the last 35 years, really appreciates the fact that this venue exists and serves the community with guests like we've had today, brilliant teachers and purveyors of cultural evolution. Now, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. That's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes, my YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcast. And thanks again to Leonard Perlmutter and to all you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.